What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of What's Up With History. My name is Taylor, and this episode we're going to be talking about the sinking of the Titanic. Now, before I get started, like usual, I'll mention my source, which was Titanic, The Death and Life of a Legend by Michael Davey. Now, the Titanic is interesting because it is an example of a cautionary tale of technological hubris on the part of people. They, in this instance, became very overconfident with their invention and believed that it was indestructible. And clearly that wasn't the case. So without further ado, we'll get right into the topic. Now, the British industry at this time had been expanding drastically in the 1860s, and shipbuilding dealt with cutthroat competition. Now, the creator of the Titanic was Canadian-born William J. Peary. He partnered with Harland and Wolff by the age of 27, which is prodigal at this time, and helped to make it the largest shipyard in the world. Now, Peary partnered with White Star Line, while he was on the board of Harland and Wolff, to make three new massive ships, the Olympic, the Titanic, and the Britannic. Now, you've probably heard of these. Definitely the Titanic. The Titanic disaster actually boomed business since safer reconstructions needed to be made, which is kind of a morbid thought that it was very economically positive. Now, Harland, the founder, reformed shipbuilding by replacing wooden decks with metal and creating square hulls, which was more room for passengers or cargo. Now, he partnered with the German engineer Gustav Wolff, and they in turn made the company the powerhouse that it was at this time. Now, Peary's career was contemporaneous with steel shipbuilding, and steel in air quotes, because it was mainly just hardened iron. It wasn't anything as strong as the steel we have nowadays. Now, the White Star Line was built by T.H. Ismay, father of J. Bruce Ismay, in 1869. Their first ship, the Royal Standard, struck an iceberg too, which is very ironic and not a very good sign for the future of the company. But nevertheless, White Star and Harland and Wolff were serious competition for the nationalistic British line Cunard. Then J.P. Morgan joined the game. Now, if you don't know who Morgan is, he was a big businessman in the Gilded Age of America, and he ran sort of a monopoly at this time, around the time that people were very antitrust. So a lot of people were trying to crack down on his business because of this. But he wanted to start a monopoly over the Atlantic. So Cunard became funded and backed by the British government, whereas White Star and Harland and Wolff teamed up with Morgan to kind of compete with them. Peary, the new chairman, made the unattractive but effective decision to join forces with Morgan, like I said, to beat Cunard in competition. And it worked in a while. So the Titanic is still considered a British ship, even though it was owned by an American. And it's generally considered Southampton's ship, because Southampton provided so many of the crew for it. This tilted industrial power from Britain to America, which was a big move at the time, which is why the Titanic is so significant. The Titanic was born out of British technology and American capital. Now, the size increase was inevitable, since transporting immigrants was way more profitable than mail or just first class. And Cunard started the races with production in 1907 of two ships that you've probably heard of, the Lusitania and Mauritania. Now, about the Titanic disaster itself, there's a theory that sabotage happened in the shipyard because of British and Irish conflict. There's no proof for this, but it's one of the theories out there for the reason why it was so unsafe. However, the Board of Trade did inspect it, and they did test runs on it, and it worked out fine. The ship was in great condition, according to them, even though their word doesn't really mean much in this case, because their regulations were so out of date. But they claimed it was in good condition, so I'm not putting much credence behind that sabotage theory. Now, there's actually no evidence of the manufacturers claiming that the ship was unsinkable. There was a focus on size and decor with the Titanic rather than speed, whereas Cunard was focusing on speed. They had smaller ships that were more fast, but with the Titanic, it was all about the size and how nice it was. So, the names of the ships were also meant to boast their size. There's an ick at the end of every word. Titanic, Britannic, Olympic. All these words that make you think of big things. The Titanic literally means large, and Olympic makes you think of Mount Olympus or something. All these words were meant to invoke that kind of feeling in the person who rides on the ship, or even sees it. At the time, most put too much faith in technology and progress in that field without an eye on what was ahead. And in this case, that was an iceberg. So, the Titanic was welcomed in Southampton as a source of jobs, like I mentioned, built in Belfast but managed, or not managed, manned by individuals from Southampton. Captain E.J. Smith was from Southampton, actually, and he took over the Titanic at the age of 62. He was a very reliable and renowned captain, and there's nothing but positive comments from the survivors about him and his conduct. However, he was very, very confident in the ship itself. He believed that it was indestructible. So the crew numbered around 891, the passengers totaled 1,317, with most in third class, or steerage, as it's called. And the Titanic left the dock very fast and almost collided with the tug, which was Smith acting reckless, maybe? The captains need to be robust in their duties due to the intense competition between companies, but maybe he was being a little bit overeager in his last trip, and we'll get more into that later. Now, the Titanic took the southern transatlantic route due to the season, which wasn't unusual at the time, even though there were icebergs there. Nowadays, we move ships accordingly based on weather patterns. Smith had to have been aware of the dangers due to the prior press stories of shipwrecks happening in the Atlantic all the time, and personal experience. He's been captaining ships for years, so he knows the dangers. There's another interesting theory that's out there about the book The Wreck of the Titan, written in 1912, which is considered prophetic about the Titanic sinking. However, there are a lot of discrepancies in details, and the time of the popularity was after the sinking of the Titanic. People noticed it after the Titanic sank, so it wasn't really prophetic since nobody knew about it beforehand. Now, there wasn't a set routine on who to send marconigrams to on the ship. For some reason, nobody thought it was a good idea to set up some sort of hierarchy of who to send your telegrams to. So, some things got lost in the shuffle. And some operators may have even ignored messages outright from other competitive wireless companies, which is not a good thing to do when you're trying to keep your passengers safe on the ocean, in my opinion. Now, Smith and the crew knew of the upcoming ice field. They have gotten at least 4 marconigrams about it from other ships. And Smith didn't know how indestructible icebergs were at this time. He thought the ship was able to plow through anything. So he did speed through the ice field at the time. They were going full speed, but it wasn't to beat a record, from contrary to what most people believe. Or not most people, some people believe that it was because of a record. Because the Titanic wasn't built for speed. So why would someone intend, why would the creator of the Titanic intend for it to beat a record if it wasn't built for speed in the first place? It was built for luxury. So that's why I don't put much credence behind that kind of theory. Now, Smith wasn't aware of the legitimate danger, or he believed it wouldn't be an issue, because a lot of people didn't actually know a lot about icebergs at this time. They knew the different sizes and where they would be, but they didn't exactly know that they were as hard as rocks. They thought that they could break through it just like you can crunch ice in a glass. However, that clearly wasn't the case. Now, Smith never ordered a boat drill because he didn't see this danger, and that was a big mistake, because since this event happened, nobody knew how to handle themselves in the situation. And either he didn't think the disaster was likely, or he thought the discrepancy in the amount of lifeboats would alarm the passengers, because on the Titanic, they didn't have enough lifeboats for everybody. And they actually had more than the border trade was regulating them to have. And a lot of people claim this was because Ismay wanted the passengers on the top decks to have a good view of the ocean and the surrounding areas. However, in my opinion, that does not come before the safety of your passengers. You need to have enough lifeboats for every single person on the ship. Now, the surviving crew had a hard time saving face for themselves and other crew members, and there were disputes over whether or not there was a haze out that night. Now, the captain and Officer Lightoller, who I'll talk about a lot more in the future, agreed that there wasn't a haze, but the lookouts, Fred Fleet and his partner, say there was. Now, there weren't any extra lookouts posted, nor did they have binoculars, which seems kind of important to have for a lookout. Now, Fred Fleet, who was the lookout on that night, he said he would have seen it sooner with binoculars, and apparently he couldn't judge distance either. That seems kind of necessary for a lookout to be able to judge distance and how far away objects are. So I'm guessing it probably wasn't because of binoculars that he didn't see it in time. He probably just couldn't judge how far away it was. So the second lookout's testimony wasn't qualified because of inconsistencies with the rest of people's interviews, and the Board of Trade never ordered new eye exams. So nobody knew that his eyesight was bad at this instance, because he hadn't had his eyes checked in at least 5 years. Now, at the moment of the hit, the watertight doors were activated, but the gash on the starboard side penetrated at least 6 rooms. Now that's way more than what the ship could handle. If it was maybe 3 or 4, the ship could stay afloat, but because it was 6, there wasn't a chance of keeping the Titanic above water. Now, people were only concerned about what happened to the interesting, wealthy, and famous passengers, which is a morbid thought, but obviously the wealthy passengers were the first ones to be mentioned in newspaper articles about whether or not they survived. And the Titanic was, it perfectly exposed the social structure of the world. It was, the stratification of the passengers was based solely on money. On the top decks and in the nice areas were the first passengers, below them in the midsection were the second passengers, and then below them, near the bottom of the ship, were the third passengers, in steerage, as it was called. And so that kind of perfectly maps out the social hierarchy at the time, which is interesting about the Titanic. The ship sort of modeled the world in a lot of ways. Now, more first class survived than third class, which gave people the question of whether or not it was privileged treatment, or if it was just circumstantial because the first class passengers were closer to the top decks. And a lot of the passengers were actually, like I said, famous, but they were related to American institutions such as the Guggenheim Museum, the New York Public Library, and Harvard's Widener Library. According to passenger Marion Thayer, all passengers had equal shots at lifeboats, though, and this was conflicted with by some steerage passengers' accounts of rope barriers and locked gates that they encountered that night, which is horrible if that's true, but we'll get more into the details about the officers and their conduct later. Now, the most reliable survivor accounts are those without nationalistic preferences or an axe to grind with somebody, so anybody who didn't have any conflicts at the time are usually pretty trustworthy. Some people were in shock or wanting to stir things up a little bit more, and so on the day of arrival, when the Carpathia reached the docks in New York, and all the reporters got their stories however they could, a lot of those stories couldn't be believed because so many people were in total shock of what happened and were coming up with random things that they could think of that they tried to remember or that they could remember. But nevertheless, we do have a lot of accurate information from a lot of people who were active during that night. So most passengers felt safe until the rockets were fired in distress. Rockets as in like bright flares, pretty much. And the band played on deck in order to calm the crowd. None of the band members survived. They stayed on the deck playing music to calm people down the entire time, which a lot of them are considered heroes because of that instance. And there were no steerage passengers called to the inquiry for some reason. In the British Inquiry, that is. Now, many of the immigrants who couldn't speak English kind of were confused even more because they didn't know what was going on, they couldn't understand what people were saying, and they were in a tough spot, which I feel for them because that's gotta be extremely scary. And I would hate to go through that myself, not being able to understand what people are saying and just seeing chaos around me. Now, some passengers believed that staying on board was safer than getting into lifeboats, and Smith didn't immediately raise the alarm. There wasn't any general strategy, but also no immediate chaos. There wasn't anything crazy going on until the ship was actually, the nose of it was under the water and people were starting to realize the ship is sinking. Now, the Titanic had less lifeboats than were necessary due to loopholes and regulations, like I mentioned, and a lot of survivors were actually the crew, because all hands on deck, and they were the first ones to know what was going on. So either British regulations, which were out of date, allowed for the decrease of lifeboats, or officers didn't want to overload the davits. They didn't think that they were capable of holding full lifeboats, even though each davit was capable of holding 4 loads of full lifeboats. So they wanted to fill them halfway so as they didn't break and drop people. and they one of the officers claimed that he wanted to load it up halfway, put it in the water, and then let other passengers fill it up through a hatch down there to fill up the rest of the boat. However, that never actually happened. Now, a lot of people claim that the officers were most likely just afraid of being rushed in a panic. Now, officers knew of the lifeboat shortage, so they possibly focused on first and second passengers due to the proximity to the deck. And all in all, plenty of wealthy passengers did die, actually. And apparently, most of the sailors were less than adept at seamanship, which is an odd thing, actually. A lot of them didn't know how to row boats or handle the davits, which were the little cranes that lower the lifeboats into the water. A lot of them didn't know how to organize those things, which you'd think they would learn being a member of the crew, but apparently they were just as much in the dark as the passengers were. Now, the reason the majority of the crew survived is probably because they were the first to know, like I mentioned. While the ship was sinking, the lifeboats believed they would be rescued by a nearby ship that apparently disappeared. Now, the end was described by Officer Lightoller as a crash when she broke in half and constant cries as the stern dived almost perpendicularly, and then there were just whispers of, in quote, "she's gone." Now, no survivor has forgotten that terrible night or the sounds or even the haunting silence afterwards. I mean, can you imagine? The ship is sinking, people are screaming, and then after the ship goes under the water, there's just the occasional moan in the water of people trying to survive or being frozen to death. And then as soon as all those voices go silent, there's just nothing. That's gotta be extremely haunting. I cannot imagine how scarring that had to have been for a lot of people. Now, very few people drowned, most actually froze to death because the water was almost below freezing. And the question was brought up at the inquiry as to why most lifeboats didn't try to save anybody. Lightoller, however, began the search for life. He took the initiative and spread people out in different lifeboats and sent them out to try to pick up whoever was still alive in the water. Which, kudos to him, he was a hero in this situation. And questions arose as to whether some passengers actively persuaded others to not help. The conduct of the Duff Gordons came into question and rumors as a stark contrast to the self-sacrifice and honor of others. Sir Duff Gordon managed to get in a lifeboat apparently because of the officer's allowance, and they were questioned at the inquiry and seemed to have been terrified in the moment and probably confused and focused on surviving themselves, but they were claimed to have actively asked the officer not to go toward the cries and help people. And like I said, it was probably because they were scared and confused and trying to stay alive themselves, and they thought the boat was going to get overcrowded, and they didn't want that. They wanted to survive like anybody would in this situation, but their conduct did come into question as whether or not that was something they actually actively tried to do. And some rumors claimed it was most likely due to class conflict. The Duff Gordons were wealthy and apparently paid officers, which led some to consider that a bribe. They, as soon as they were rescued, they paid the officers £5 each, which is interesting. It may just be their way of showing appreciation for the help that the officers did for them, but some people consider that a type of bribe in a way. Now, there are a lot of controversies surrounding the tragedy, and I'm going to go over most of those right now. The first one is Captain Lord of the Californian, who was bashed for not going to the aid of the Titanic. He's the ship that they claim to have seen that night. However, he claims to have seen a ship as well that wasn't the Titanic. So there's a confusion of a third ship, maybe there wasn't a third ship. All these things will come to light later. Now, both American and British inquiries condemned him for his works, and actually claimed that he was the only one in this situation who actually broke the law by not going to the aid of another ship. Now, the Californian stopped at the same ice field as the Titanic, and saw a nearby ship as well that wouldn't respond to Morse. And so, the nearby ship seen by them, was that the Titanic, or was it some other ship? Now, Officer Stone of the Californian assumed the other ship was actually a tramp steamer. Now, why that was in the middle of the Atlantic, nobody really knows for sure. The Californian received word of the Titanic at 4 a.m. when the Carpathia was already on its way. Now, Captain Rostron's Carpathia rescued the lifeboats while the Californian double-checked for survivors in the area, but didn't find any. It landed in Boston after the Carpathia, and it was immediately questioned. as soon as they landed. Now, Lord talked to the press and was remembered by a reporter during the hearing in the inquiry, and there was suggestions that his conduct needed to be questioned at this situation. So, Officer Gill got paid by the press to tell his story, which put Lord in a bad spot. No other ship was found from that area, so Lord's claims could not be corroborated, and Lord was censured by Lord Mercy in the British hearing, and Lord was considered a bad witness who didn't really help his case. He apparently didn't answer questions very well, or very articulately at the time. Now, Lord was forced to resign from Leyland Line, but was rehired by another company later, and retired in 1927 with a perfect record afterwards. So his conduct later didn't harm him in any way. He was apparently a great captain afterwards. Now, a report was made in 1992 after a request to review the evidence. Again, the conclusion that he should have taken action was made, and it was still a ship in distress, if not the Titanic, because they still saw the rockets going up. However, they said it was off time with when they were fired on the Titanic. All other details came up into question. But nevertheless, if it was a ship in distress, they should have acted. So, either way. Now, the main arguments were location inaccuracies. The ship was seen moving when the Californian wasn't. The lifeboats never saw a ship. The rocket sightings were not at the same time, like I mentioned. No one on the Californian heard the rockets. And the Californian shouldn't have been able to see the Titanic's lights based on the direction it was facing. All these different details came into question at the inquiry. Now, the public wanted someone to blame, obviously, for this tragedy, and Lord couldn't keep his story straight, so obviously he was one of the perfect candidates for that kind of situation. Now, another dilemma was with J. Bruce Ismay himself and his conduct on his ship. Now, he was essentially broken by the disaster. He was not the same afterwards, so as much as he did to survive, I don't know, I have a hard time thinking that he deserved what actually happened to him afterwards. He had a wealthy upbringing, a tough father, and under advice of Peary, Ismay sold to Morgan and became the very wealthy director of the new monopoly, International Mercantile Marine. Now, this is seen as a negative thing by him, as failing in his father's footsteps of keeping the company its own thing and powerful. He's considered a reserved and strict man. He helped people get into lifeboats, actually, when the disaster was occurring, and he got into the last one. Now, no passengers were on the deck, according to Ismay. However, he was cited by passengers to be in a hysterical state. Now, Officer Lowe claims he was acting excited and anxious, demanding a boat to be lowered immediately. So there are all these conflicting reports about his conduct, and nobody knows for sure how he was acting in this situation. Curiously, he never attempted to communicate with any of the authorities while on board on the ship. He claimed he was just a passenger, which he clearly wasn't, since he was the owner of the ship, and he had total authority even over the captain of the ship. So, he clearly wasn't just a passenger. Now, while he was in a lifeboat, he claimed to have seen a light of a sailing ship. Was that an illusion? A star? Or was it the Californian? Or this mysterious third ship that was apparently in the area? Now, afterwards, he was obsessed with the idea of going down with the ship. Was this survivor's remorse? Maybe. Maybe not. Now, he was the first to be questioned by the inquiry, since he was planning on heading back to London as soon as possible. This was probably because he was apprehensive about the awkward questions he was going to be asked. Now, he got full coverage in every paper the next day, and they all blamed the disaster on Ismay. He was ruthlessly cross-examined by the Senate and the Board of Trade. Ismay constantly feigned ignorance, although he clearly had to have known something. Maybe he was in shock, truly didn't know anything, or decided to keep things quiet, or all three. You know, I mean, I like to think that he was probably in a little bit of shock, but he also didn't want to give too much information away just so he didn't make himself look bad. But this, in turn, made him look bad. So it was kind of a catch-22 situation. Now, William Carter suggests Officer Wilde asked the Carters and Ismay to get into the boat. So this is another situation like the Duff Gordons, where the officer may have asked him to get in the boat. So it wasn't exactly any sort of misconduct on his part. Now, he claimed that he did not influence the ship's speed, but is reported mentioning firing up two more boilers to the Thayers. So clearly he had it in mind. Smith also gave him a marconogram about the upcoming ice field, so he was aware of that too, though he claims he didn't know what to do with this. could they have gotten out of danger if he had made a decision about going around it? He agreed and inadvertently implied influence on the speed with the questions that he was asked at the inquiry. He was also blamed for the inadequate amount of lifeboats, which I agree was his fault. He claims that it was not required by the Board of Trade and he didn't want to affect the view of the passengers. So one of those reasons seems legitimate, but blocking the view of the passengers, I don't know. Like, I understand that from a commercial standpoint, you want your passengers to enjoy the ship and the ride to America, but when it comes to the safety of them, that does come first, in my opinion. Now, he resigned from director soon after this, even though this was supposed to be his final triumph at the time. The next dilemma, the third one on this list, there's a lot of scandals that surround this event, but the next one has to do with Marconi. Now, William Randolph Hearst's New York Times was the ultimate medium for testimonies and allegations, and Victorian beliefs were at the heart of most people's issues with Ismay. They believed that he should have gone down with the ship, like the father of the company that he was. However, that nowadays, people would probably be okay with the fact that he tried to survive. It would be understood, at least. Now, Marconi's invention saved hundreds of lives at this event, and most ships had his device by 1912, which were wireless messages. Now, operators worked solely for Marconi. They didn't work for the ship, the company. They worked straight for Marconi. They were paid by Marconi, solely their own businessmen on the ship. Now, the Californian operator went to bed, but the Carpathia operator made a last-minute check and caught the distress signal. So the Titanic chief operator became an immediate hero for sending out these signals. Now, accurate reporting, however, wasn't easy. Survivors either exaggerated or were hysterical, making most testimonies unreliable. The operator Harold Bride, who was a survivor, describes events in the radio cabin and how relentless operator Phillips was in getting help. He altered aspects of his story in the hearing, though, which brings some credibility into question. And he established both legends of Phillips' heroism and the band that played as the ship sank to maintain some calm. Now, he never messaged the press while on the Carpathia for some reason, and he ignored requests for info from both governments, both Britain and America. He didn't respond to their messages and didn't give anybody information about the disaster for some reason, him or the operator on the Carpathia. So the reasons were, according to them, that American operators did not know Continental Morse, which was false. Company rules that they shouldn't message shore stations via other ships, which is false. And that Captain Rostron told them not to, which is also false. Captain Rostron told them to do whatever they could in this situation. Now, Cottam, who was the operator on the Carpathia, and Bride were in a very profitable position by this. Marconi's employees' conduct brought the power of monopolies into question. Marconi essentially had a news monopoly since he controlled the international medium, and the New York Times got the first interviews with them. Now, Marconi claims ignorance about this deal between his company and the Times. Probably not true, since he had dinner with a Times reporter and went directly to the Carpathia, got through the crowd of almost 30,000 people that were being held back. Now, the American Marconi Company director, Bottomley, stated at an inquiry that he gave the go-ahead for the employees and the Times for paid exclusives. Marconi had to have known this either before or after the dinner with Bottomley. He was having dinner with Bottomley when the reporter showed up, and they went straight to the Carpathia. Now, Senator Smith wanted to expose Marconi's monopoly, but didn't have the support. Both Cottam and Bride went back to work for Marconi afterwards. So the whole scandal surrounding this is that supposedly Cottam and Bride were paid to have exclusive reports with the Times that was agreed to by Marconi, and that's why they didn't send out any messages while on the ship, because they were saving all their information for that first exclusive interview, which apparently, according to the evidence, did happen, and it's probably true, but Marconi claims ignorance about this whole situation, and there's no evidence to support otherwise. However, I personally believe that he 100% knew about this and approved it. Now, the other dilemma was with Senator Smith. The Titanic disaster revealed the not-so-obvious attitudes between Britain and America, which were tense at this time, and about 50-odd years before the disaster had shown immense creation of industry and monopolies. Ismay was targeted because of how he represented the upper aristocracy of the old world. The British responded to this ethical attack by making Senator Smith appear as a joke in their papers. Shipping lines made relations seem good. British lines carried Americans to vacation spots in Europe, and American lines carried immigrants and businessmen to America. So all seemed good on the outside. Now, many British people didn't like being questioned by Americans about their conduct. Smith was also antitrust, so he targeted the British ambassador James Bryce, who used to be president of the Board of Trade. So he's got some backing and experience. Smith halted many of Bryce's attempts at trade treaties, thinking that it would harm the working class of America. Now, the inquiry was actually Smith's idea, so he was obviously appointed as head. The inquiry gave him the rare opportunity to bring the public behind him against shipping trusts. Smith immediately had the Navy intercept Marconigrams sent by Ismay, which is how they knew that he was trying to head back to London as soon as possible. Now, Britain claimed the inquiry is just America's means of getting the spotlight, which was probably true. So, Bryce went to London to protest the inquiry. British citizens acted as witnesses freely, though, so they couldn't exactly protest something that their own citizens were freely taking part in. And Smith was aware of Britain's suspicions at the time. He wasn't an idiot. He knew what was going on. Now, Smith wasn't the best at interrogating, but he couldn't be pressured and remained true to the task. He also knew what he wanted to know and where and how to find it. So he was very dogged in his interrogation skills. Now, the American inquiry brought class resentment and the broader picture to light, since Smith questioned so many passengers. Smith's criticisms involved the overconfidence of the captain, the haphazard organization of the escape, the higher proportion of lower class losses, the partially loaded lifeboats, some crew members abandoned their stations during this event, the sort of anarchist use of the wireless machines, and Captain Lord's conduct, and Ismay's presence affecting the speed. Now, as a result, shipping lanes were moved south, the ice patrol was created, and new rules around shipping regulations were created as well. The wireless operators were reformed, rockets were used only in distress, and sea traffic was regulated for safer travel. So he was sort of the front runner for bringing all these things to light, but the credit can't be given to him solely. Now, trusts needed to reveal more information about ownership and finances after this too, which he was probably very happy about. And like I said, he can't be given the most credit for this, but he did bring their needs to light. Now, in the British inquiry, in Britain, crowds gathered outside of the White Star offices in protest, and rightfully so. Now, the question was, how could the board that declared the Titanic safe possibly be trusted to inquire in its sinking? Questions over whether Lord Mercy, who was the head of the British inquiry, would whitewash the disaster. Now, Mercy was chosen due to his extensive knowledge in shipping and maritime law, since he worked in that business as a younger man. He was a delegate for Britain at Versailles after World War I, so he was obviously experienced and trusted. So the Board of Trade made its own minor investigation into its own vulnerability in this case before Mercy was even elected. And lifeboats were the first issue addressed, obviously, and the height of the bulkheads was the second issue. Now, unlike Smith, Mercy was thorough in his interrogations, asking over 25,000 questions. Mercy had a habit of coming to conclusions before hearing all the evidence, though, which made a lot of people upset. The final report was similar to Smith's, but Captain Smith was not reprimanded, and so White Star wasn't either, which angered a lot of people. It never reprimanded Ismay either, claiming steerage passengers were treated equally and didn't address many issues addressed by Senator Smith. It was unlikely Mercy meant to whitewash the tragedy for the board, though. He probably just wanted to let the dead rest and not stir up any more civil unrest, which was clearly happening at this time. Which, if that's the case, then I respect that, honestly. Now, Mercy, however, reached the underwhelming conclusion that no one was responsible. White Star was deemed guilty a year later, however, in an appeals court when a member of a family sued them. He also didn't address Marconi's profits after this instance. Now, after the Titanic sank and people realized how useful Marconi's technology was, business boomed for him. Now, interest in the Titanic faded in the years following the inquiries, recalled usually when a survivor passed away or on the anniversary of the event. However, a movie hosted in a theater in Indiana Orchard, Massachusetts, affected a man named Henry Kamuda, who went on to found the Titanic Enthusiasts of America Society in 1963, which was soon renamed the Titanic Historical Society. Now, Dr. Robert Ballard, the discoverer of the Titanic wreck, was encouraged and supported by the society, and his expedition was based out of Woods Hole, Massachusetts, which isn't that far away from Indiana Orchard. The Titanic discovery gave Woods Hole and Dr. Ballard much-needed funding and notoriety at the time. Now, Dr. Ballard had history in the U.S. Navy and has a PhD in marine geology and geophysics, and Woods Hole has a successful history and connections to the military. Now, Ballard, a senior scientist in the Ocean Engineering Department and head of the Deep Submergence Laboratory at the time, became interested in the Titanic for purely technical reasons. It was at a depth of about 13,000 feet in the ocean, and they had just outfitted their submarine, Alvin, I believe, to be able to go to that depth. So he wanted to send Alvin down there to test and see if it was actually capable of surviving at that depth. Now, Ballard began his first expedition on July 11th, 1985, and covered about 80% of his 150 square miles square on the ocean floor, although he was not successful. Now, the second trip on a different vessel was successful when at 1:40 a.m. on September 1st, a boiler appeared on the screen. Now, you can go to Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute's website and see these first pictures of the Titanic wreck. These are amazing images of the first ones that we've seen of the Titanic in over 75 years at the time, and they are haunting in a lot of ways. It's a very sobering experience to see these images, especially when you see the crow's nest with the phone still there and just hanging on its cord. Ballard held a memorial service that morning in remembrance of the people who died at the wreck, because they were floating over the top of the grave of almost 1,500 people. Now, the wreck was found about 10 miles east of where it was originally thought to be, and they concluded that the California was actually much closer than suggested, which brings Captain Lord's words into a lot more critical light. Now, many people suggested raising and rebuilding her, but a bill was passed in November of 1985 that barred anyone from disturbing the, quote, maritime memorial, end quote. The Titanic is preserved in the freezing temperatures at about 2.5 miles down, and Ballard surprisingly found no evidence of gash on the side, but the plates had popped open. So there wasn't any huge cut in the side of the ship, but the plates on the side that were riveted together had popped open, which is why the rooms were flooded. Now, popular places connected to the Titanic are Central Square in Southampton, the Slipway in Belfast, where Harlan and Wolff constructed the ship, and the park in New York City, which is located on the site of the old Strauss family farm. And if you don't know, the Strausses are connected to Macy's, the store. But the most emotional of all locations are the cemeteries in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Halifax is the site of a shore wireless station that was in contact with other ships that night, and it's also where the bodies of victims were collected on the morning of April 30, 1912. Now, the author, Michael Davey, talked about how he had visited these places, and it was a sobering experience to be able to see these places in person and walk among the graves and see what was written on each one on how that individual may have died or who it was. There was one that was a 14-year-old girl who had died, and DNA testing claimed who she was. I believe her name was Sarah Goldwyn. And it's a sobering experience seeing all those graves and knowing that so many people died in this wreck where people were just overconfident in the capabilities of technology. And it's an interesting story that I loved reading about and definitely loved telling you guys about. And I hope you guys enjoyed hearing about this. This is probably one of my favorite episodes I've done so far, just because the topic is so interesting. I used to be obsessed with the Titanic, but I never knew this stuff about it. So this was it was really interesting for me to read about this stuff. And hopefully you guys found it interesting too. There's a lot more to this story than you would think right off the bat. So thank you all so much for listening to this episode. Let me know if I can change anything or do anything better about these episodes. If there's anything you guys don't like or do like. Or give me suggestions about next topics. I'm definitely open to those. Be sure to follow me on social media at JTPepper02 on Twitter and Instagram. And again, thank you all so much for listening. Hope you all have a good one.